Primal Leadership by Daniel Goldman, Richard Boyatzis, and Annie McKee. Continued, Cassette 6, Side 1. They take the conversation to the organization as a whole, using engaging processes to get people viscerally involved in unearthing the current reality while tapping into individual and collective hopes for the future. Like Lang Chen, these leaders enable people to identify both the best aspects of the organization as well as its faults, and they help to create a shared language about the current reality, releasing energy for the move to a shared vision of the future. The critical shift, moving from dissonance to the ideal vision. Once the cultural reality has been uncovered and explored, the next stage in working toward an emotionally intelligent organization requires defining an ideal vision for the organization that is in sync with individuals' hopes and dreams for themselves. By acting from a place of emotional intelligence and modeling that behavior, leaders can help their employees embrace an ideal vision for the group. What does an organization look like whose members are attuned to a common vision? Consider Lucasfilm, headquartered in Marin County, California, and the parent company of a number of producer George Lucas's creative media companies. Perhaps the first things that strike anyone who meets Gordon Radley, the president of Lucasfilm Limited, are the small tattoo hash marks on his cheekbone. Those tattoos mark Radley as a member of a tribe in Malawi with whom he lived for 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in the late 1960s. 30 years later, he still stays in touch with his friends among the Malawi tribe, even making small grants to help them put tin roofs on their wattle huts or start a small business. It's unlike any place we on the outside know, yet it's a coherent world that stayed very much the same, says Radley, telling of a recent visit back to Malawi. Being there put me in touch with how much I love these people. Being part of a tribe has always had some special meaning. Likewise, that almost tribal sense of belonging to a special group, of inhabiting a unique world together, characterizes places people love to work. For Radley, one of his responsibilities as a leader is to nurture and maintain the company culture at Lucasfilm. Of the empire George Lucas created and owns, Lucasfilm is the parent company for the legendary special effects house Industrial Light and Magic, as well as a string of other creative media companies in sectors ranging from video games to sound systems for theaters. For Radley, the best corporate culture is not unlike the tribal feeling he experienced in the Peace Corps. Of his mission, Radley says, "How do you create that tribal feeling? It's a hard thing to do because it's so evanescent it disappears as soon as you draw attention to it. But we want to make sure how we feel about what we do is just as important as what we do." Unquote. One way such feelings emerge can be through creating extraordinary moments, experiences people go through together that become part of the shared mythology. A few years ago, the company was feeling some very rough edges, Radley recalls. "So I organized an all-company meeting. It had never happened before, getting everyone together in one room. We had to meet in the auditorium of a local community center. I started the meeting off in a routine way, with 20 minutes of financial results, corporate updates, and the like. And then I suddenly pulled back a curtain, and there was the cast of the Broadway musical Stomp. No one had been expecting anything like it." Unquote. For 2 hours, the entire company was galvanized by the performance, an entirely nonverbal, all-percussive enactment of spontaneous attunement. Stomp's ingenious choreography shows how, using prosaic objects like brooms, buckets, mops, and plungers, a single person can initiate a rhythm that others can join and elaborate in a gorgeous, creative synchrony. It's a wordless ode to the power of a group in resonance. "It was an electric moment," says Radley. "It bonded everyone without a word being spoken. I did it because I wanted to bring everyone together, to create a special sense that we're all involved in working together for something bigger than just ourselves. We want to create a culture where people have compassion for each other. It's like the Peace Corps. We're serving each other. A great company culture has empathy. Hopefully, that becomes a shared value. You do these little symbolic things and hope they set the tone. Unquote. That moment exemplifies what Radley calls guerrilla development, a subtle shaping of the company's culture. But the fragile nature of a group's culture means the shaping cannot be forced. As Radley says, you set the table and hope people will come and sit down. For instance, Radley had to struggle with his own senior leaders at an early company meeting to get the chairs put in a huge circle. The seating itself signaled that tribal feeling, he recalls. We had everyone introduce themselves and tell where they grew up. By the end of that introductory circle, everyone had the sense that we had come together from all over to be part of this group at this moment. Unquote. Such transitory moments of good feeling, of course, mean little if they are not matched by the ongoing workaday reality. As a company, Lucasfilm has a reputation as a very desirable place to work, the kind of reputation that gives the company an edge in attracting and retaining talent in the San Francisco Bay Area's competitive employment environment. The companies that form Lucasfilm are among the few that have shown up on Best Companies to Work For lists in such magazines as Fortune and Working Mother. The degree of an organization's tribal feel can be a good indication of how well it has identified its ideal vision and aligned people around that common purpose. But how do leaders help their organizations to unearth an ideal vision in the first place? They begin with a close scrutiny of themselves, of their personal dreams, and of their ideal visions for the organizations that they lead. Inspiration and the Hour of the Rat. Connecting with a vision that can build resonance starts within, as Anthony Berkmans, co-chairman of Unilever, tells us. As we launched into our growth strategy, I realized that I didn't feel right. Something was missing, and I knew we would need to look again at our plans. I trusted my feeling. You learn to listen to that inner voice. So I looked for the source of my uneasiness. We were doing all the right things. A new focused strategy, shareholder support, a new organization structure, and good people in place. But something was wrong. The critical piece was missing. What I saw was that even though we had an excellent change strategy and an inspiring vision, what was really required to bring about change at Unilever was a new culture, a new leadership mindset, and new behaviors. Unquote. Neil Fitzgerald, co-chairman and co-creator of the transformation process, weighs in. We knew where we needed to go, that was completely clear. We had all the organizational pieces in place, but it was like standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon. You know you have to get to the other side, but to do so, you know you will have to take a big leap, then build a bridge. You feel anticipation, even deep uneasiness, but the excitement of the vision calls you on to build that bridge, take that leap. I paid attention to the feelings, especially the ones that let me know that something wasn't quite right, not yet. These feelings were important. For me as a leader, they led me to see what we needed to do. At Unilever, the bridge we needed to build was all about people. We needed to tap into their passion, we needed them to see their business in entirely new ways, and we needed them to develop very different leadership behaviors. Fitzgerald's and Bergman's soul-searching led to a radically fresh approach to transforming the company, starting with changing the mindset of Unilever's top leaders. Today, Unilever is in the midst of profound change, but unlike many change efforts, there is tremendous clarity throughout the organization about what is being done and why. People know they are part of the change, and they know they need to change too. In terms of financial and organizational measures, they are ahead of schedule. All this because two leaders listen to the voice within. To connect with the kind of vision that can move a culture toward resonance, emotionally intelligent leaders start by looking inside at what they feel, think, and sense about their organizations. They act as highly sensitive instruments to connect with the company's ideal vision and mission, and they notice the gaps between what could be and what is. This isn't intuition. It's using emotional intelligence to observe and interpret the subtle clues about what's really going on, and it offers leaders a perspective that goes beyond other kinds of data about the company. Tapping into that kind of insight can come more easily if a leader makes a habit of retreating to a quiet place to reflect on a regular basis. Reaching into the wisdom of the unconscious mind is like trying to pump water from a deep well. It helps to keep the pump primed, in this case, by regularly spending time in reflection. Often, that deep wisdom comes in the middle of the night, during what we call the hour of the rat, that dark, quiet time of the night when no one is around and things start to gnaw at you. It is those times of quiet reflection that can begin to offer a leader answers to nagging questions. What's bothering me so much that I just can't seem to let it go, even at home? What's confusing, muddled, ambiguous, or just plain irritating? Where is the passion, excitement, and meaning in my work? What do I really believe in? By examining the sources of their anxiety and their passion, and by focusing on their own dreams, leaders can begin to identify aspects of the organization's culture, of its overarching mission and vision, and of its leadership, including their own, that need to change. Only through articulating for themselves what keeps people in the organization, beyond just a job, can leaders connect with the kind of resonant vision that people will be able to see and feel. To create the vision of a company, emotionally intelligent leaders need to move beyond a solo scrutiny of an organization's vision to drawing on the collective wisdom of followers. Side by side with the rest of the organization, leaders co-create the vision that will serve to rally and energize the group as a whole. Involving people in a deliberate study of themselves and the organization, first by looking at the reality and then at the ideal vision, builds resonance and sustainable change. Consider the examples that follow of leaders who have helped their organizations to rally around a common vision of what could be. Attunement, not alignment. Keki Dadaseth took over as chairman of Hindustan Lever Limited, or HLL, at a time of rapid change in the Indian business environment. Successful and leading edge in its management practices and results over a period of time, the company nevertheless needed to shed a culture which, in the new environment, was seen as bureaucratic, closed door, and lacking in transparency. Activities were highlighted almost as often as achievements, and cultural norms supported the hierarchy rather than full empowerment. Thus, it was often difficult to get things done speedily. Although the company had a well-defined management development process, queries were raised regarding how people were promoted or rewarded because there was a perceived lack of transparency. Keki Dadaseth took this challenge head-on. He moved toward the ideal by becoming an exemplar himself. He modeled the changes he wanted to see, involving people in the process of creating a new vision and a new reality. His concept was centrifuged leadership, that the center of gravity was not just the chairman. Everyone was central to success. Within a year, the culture changed such that people acknowledged the openness, trust, and empowerment within the company. HLL continues, as in the past, to be one of Unilever's most profitable and highly regarded businesses. The UNICEF immunization project in India was doing critically important work, but its chief of health, Monica Sharma, felt that the program itself needed a shot in the arm. While the project was inherently inspiring to the staff working closely with the health teams who immunized children in poor villages, most of the organization's 400 staff people, clerks, accountants, and administrators, were too far removed from that energizing field work to feel inspired. Monica decided to bring the excitement of the front lines into the back office, so she devised a plan and encouraged all office staff to spend several days regularly in a district where the real work, immunizing children, was going on. The top leadership of the office, Representative Aimee Watanabe and her two deputies, Thomas McDermott and Lucas Hendrada, were instrumental in this success because they each personally backed her fully and encouraged this initiative. As a result, staff members got to experience for themselves the mission and ideal vision that underpinned their work, and they were able to bond with each other around a more unified purpose. The major restructuring process that the University of Pennsylvania undertook in the 1990s, although necessary, was painful for many of its staff. Until the changes, most people had felt a very special connection with Penn, an Ivy League school, and considered their employment there to be a job for life. But as roles and responsibilities shifted dramatically, people were shaken out of years of complacency and security. Mostly, they felt demoralized about losing the image they'd had of themselves. To keep Penn on track with its change agenda, President Judith Roden and Executive Vice President John Fry looked to a broader agenda for inspiration that could be shared with the entire community. It was that word, community, that got them started on a process that created resonance and engaged people both inside and outside the university around a common vision. Leaders often talk about wanting to get their people aligned with their strategy, but that word suggests a mechanical image of getting all the pencils pointing in the same direction, like a magnetic field lining up the polarity of molecules. It isn't that simple. Strategies, couched as they are in the dry language of corporate goals, speak mainly to the rational brain, the neocortex. Strategic visions and the plans that follow from them are typically linear and limited, bypassing the elements of heart and passion essential for building commitment. As each of the previous examples illustrates, getting people to really embrace change requires attunement, alignment with the kind of resonance that moves people emotionally as well as intellectually. The challenge is in how to attune people to your vision and then to your business strategy in a way that arouses passion. Emotionally intelligent leaders know that this attunement requires something more than simply making people aware of the strategy itself. It requires a direct connection with people's emotional centers. Attunement, rather than mere alignment, offers the motivating enthusiasm for an organizational vision. When this attunement takes hold, people feel the heat of a collective excitement, of many people being enthusiastic about their work. A vision that tunes people in, that creates resonance, builds organizational harmony and people's capacity to act collectively. The invisible threads of a compelling vision weave a tapestry that binds people together more powerfully than any strategic plan. And people, not the business plan alone, determine the outcome. Success depends on what an organization's people care about, what they do, and how they work together. Warren Bennis, University of Southern California professor and renowned leadership expert, has called attunement managing attention through the vision, something he says is the leader's fundamental responsibility, as is using the group ideal to focus people's efforts. Attunement is especially important when the organization is undergoing significant change in how things are done, and is equally critical whenever a vision that built an organization's initial success grows stale and needs freshening. Attunement starts with involving people deeply in the process of looking at gaps between the organization's emotional reality and people's ideal visions of the organization, including visions of their own interactions within it. However, the leader must go one step further and put the people in the organization in charge of the change process itself. That's what each of the leaders in the previous examples did. Let's take a more in-depth look at each of those scenarios and see how these leaders attuned their organizations to a common vision and brought about lasting change. Be the change you want to see. Keki Dadaseth and Hindustan Lever. Keki Dadaseth, the new chairman of Hindustan Lever Limited, took over at a time of profound change in the Indian business environment. HLL had a rich heritage of management excellence and business growth, and was regarded by its peers as a company that they most wanted to emulate. Although HLL was well regarded and successful, Dataseth quickly realized that in the present liberalization scenario in India, the company needed to change quickly and shed an ingrained culture that the new environment saw as bureaucratic and lacking in transparency. To make inroads into such a deeply ingrained culture and attune the company to his vision, Dataseth knew it would take more than just talk, new policies, or even training. He needed to demonstrate consistently the behaviors he wished to see. A framed Japanese print in his office came to be his motto, "None of us is as smart as all of us." From the outset, he used the engaging style of affiliative leadership, backed up by a healthy dose of the democratic style, a combination that was not very common in the company. He gave up his scheduling diary and kept an open-door policy, never denying an employee request to talk with him. And he really listened when people talked. He took counsel from them, incorporating their views into the decisions that were being made. He broke down the hierarchy by eating with staff in the cafeteria, and he connected with people on a personal level. He came to know whose son was ill and whose daughter had won a prize at school. He learned who really cared about their work, and he praised them publicly. And where he saw difficulties, he encouraged and empowered people to come up with their own solutions. He centrifuged decision-making, pushing it as far down the organization as possible. In general, he called on people to look deeply into themselves to discover what was right for the business and to act on it. Although Dataseth's new style of leadership was at first suspect, soon it became clear it was not an act. This was the real thing. He was so available, so accessible, and so transparent that no one had to speculate or try to maneuver around him. His connections with people were sincere, and the outcome of these positive, very human relationships was mutual trust and respect. What's more, it spread. Other leaders began to see the value in redirecting people's energy toward group commitment. People began emulating Dataseth's stance, and the norms of the culture gradually shifted toward openness and mutuality. The managing up mindset was broken. There was little time wasted in unnecessary speculation, and things started getting done faster and better. Over time, as people began supporting each other through successes and difficulties alike, the cooperative spirit in the company increased. It suddenly felt safer to take on responsibility, making it easier for people to innovate and to become creative about their part of the business. From factory worker to senior manager, ideas began to flow in all parts and levels of the company, and efficiency and effectiveness increased. While building strong, open relationships in the company, Dataseth was careful to keep his eye on his goal, to improve the organization's performance. As he put it, "Comfort in relationship brings discomfort in accountability," and he made sure that relationships didn't get too cozy. So, even as he called on the company's leadership to see their connections to employees as important to the business, he also insisted on a new sense of accountability to the company, to one another, and to their own values. As a result, things began to move more quickly and smoothly. Decisions that had taken weeks in the past now took hours or even minutes, even though more people were involved. Commitment to the decisions went up, partly because of the high degree of involvement, but also because people began to trust leadership more. People now found it harder to hide or to blame others. Relationships had become based more on trust and real connection, and leaders started taking more responsibility for themselves. Within a year, performance across a range of behavioral criteria improved dramatically. The speed and effectiveness of strategy implementation were markedly increased, and the growth agenda was owned by virtually everyone in the company. People acted on it at all levels. Keki Dataseth had led by doing. He demonstrated principles of the new organization that he and his team hoped to create: transparency, inclusiveness, honesty, rigor, and results, accurate and honest assessment of what was working and what was not, and linking rewards to accomplishments. By essentially using the powerful symbol that his office represented in order to model change, DataSeth had helped people to understand and act on new standards of accountability. In short, he changed the ground rules, attuned people to a new vision for the organization, and created resonance. Throughout this organizational alchemy, Keki DataSeth took the time needed to follow the same basic rules that can trigger change. 1. Focus people's attention on the underlying issues and solutions to create common ground and understanding about what needs to change and why. By helping to articulate problems and surfacing the covert, hidden habits that people take for granted, the real state of the organization becomes apparent and is a motivating force for change. Making the covert overt gives people a language to discuss what is working and what isn't in the organization, and common ground to stand on while looking to the future. 2. Focus on the ideal, combining resonance-building leadership styles to get people talking about their hopes for the future and to tap into the dedication people feel for the organization. Connecting people's personal goals with a meaningful vision makes it safe to explore ways to reach the vision. 3. Move from talk to action. This starts with the leader. Bringing people together around a dream, moving from talk to action, and modeling new behaviors, this is the leader's charge. And it is something that UNICEF's Monica Sharma understood as well. Living the Mission, Monica Sharma and UNICEF. In 1989, when she became Chief of Health of UNICEF's Health Section Immunization Project in India, Monica Sharma understood the importance of the work the organization was doing. Far too many children in that country were dying needlessly from common and preventable childhood diseases such as measles, and her project's goal was to change that sad fact. But early on, Monica sensed something that troubled her. Most of the 400 employees felt far away from the organization's mission and the inspiring work that they themselves supported in their day-to-day jobs. Because most staff worked at desks in the main office, they didn't have access to the sense of purpose that the health teams felt as they moved from village to village immunizing children. Monica came up with a solution that would truly attune people to the common mission by connecting them emotionally to their work and therefore with their own ideal visions of their purpose in the organization. I hatched a scheme to get absolutely everyone involved in the field work of the project, Monica told us. She lobbied UNICEF's senior management to let her send every one of the over 400 office-bound staff people to work in village immunization clinics. Senior leadership supported her plan. Representative Aimee Watanabe and her deputies Thomas McDermott and Lucas Hendrada recognized that especially in a large bureaucracy, if there was going to be innovation and change, they needed to back the change agent. And they did. Staff members were able to see, many for the first time, what their work was really about. They helped gather children together and bring them to the clinics. They saw, up close, the health teams at work. For the first time, they were able to feel the raw emotions that underlay their daily work, excitement and hope, alongside the doubts and fears of the mothers, who themselves were scared by the syringes and were frightened for their children. Gradually, the workers in the home office came to see that each of their roles contributed to saving the life of a child, and that even seemingly unimportant or routine tasks were actually critical. The story of one UNICEF driver is a poignant case in point. Whereas in the past he had seen his job as simply to shuttle the health team from one district to the next, never really connecting with the people in those villages, once he had spent time working in a village clinic, everything changed. He began to take a new interest in what was happening while he waited to take his passengers back to the office. He began to talk more to the workers and the village mothers. He saw the children's and their mothers' fear, and he saw how difficult it was for some mothers to comfort their children. On his own, the driver started gathering small groups of mothers around his car, talking to them about why the immunizations were so important reassuring them about side effects and advising on how to calm the children down. He created his own many seminars, contributing palpably to the success of each clinic. The driver's impromptu work resulted in calmer, more informed parents and clinics that ran with more ease and efficiency. Moreover, he improved how the doctors and nurses on the medical team viewed the contributions of office staff, and clearly the driver himself felt a far deeper commitment to his work. That deeper commitment made an enormous difference one day when he drove a team to a village where, after several hours, the vaccine still had not arrived. In the past, the driver might have shrugged and taken the team back to the office. After all, it wasn't his job to get the vaccine there, nor would he necessarily be compensated for working overtime to help with the situation. Now, however, he understood how disappointed his class of mothers and children would be if they didn't receive the vaccine they'd been waiting for. He set off on his own to a larger but distant village, and in a few hours, he returned with the vaccine. The driver was acting on the new cultural norms. Get involved, look for places to contribute, and live the mission. By getting people at all levels to embrace and attune to their mission, Monica Sharma fostered resonance that would far outlast any simple change program. In fact, the staff had joined her in creating that vision of their mission. Monica's visionary leadership style helped people to see how their own small contributions, whether back in the office or out on the road, actually affected the children. She realized that in order for people to make their efforts meaningful, they need to see and feel the results of their work, to see the ways in which what they do supports what they believe. At the same time, it was possible that a one-time visit to the field might simply fade in people's memory if the changes stopped there. But Monica understood that in order for these inspiring moments to translate into new ways of operating together, into new cultural norms that would be sustainable over time, people would need more. They would have to talk over their experiences, to share the feelings and their learning, and to tell each other the stories that would come to define their new culture. To that end, Monica held open meetings on weekends at which people could come together to share their experiences. Then, as people began to talk about the challenges they encountered and ask for advice, Monica used a coaching leadership style to model interactions. People began to learn to coach each other. These meetings were marked by laughter, encouragement, and camaraderie. People were engaged and inspired and felt wonderful about their work together. Even now, years later, some of the staff in India remember Monica's initiative as a turning point, perhaps the most inspiring of their work lives. What mattered, too, was their leader's confidence in them, her belief that they could go to the districts and help, even though they were not trained. That confidence enabled many, like the driver, to go beyond their own expectations of themselves. And they remember that Monica made herself personally available to them, supporting their learning all through the process. Of course, Monica knew exactly what she was doing. She was attuning people with a mission that exemplified UNICEF values and providing them tangible ways to make the vision a reality. By working with people's emotions and building on their very human need for meaningful work, Monica helped to attune people's values and contributions to the greater mission. That is resonant leadership in action, engaging people's passion and connecting them with a vision of what could be. Monica Sharma fulfilled her primal task as a leader. But what about when an organization requires adjustments that reach far beyond attitude? Adjustments that involve profound changes in the way people do their jobs. In the midst of that kind of change, resonance with the vision is sometimes the one thing that holds people together, staves off exhaustion, and keeps people focused and positive. We saw this at the University of Pennsylvania as it faced a crisis in the 1990s. Attuning with the community. Judith Roden and John Fry and the University of Pennsylvania. In the mid to late 1990s, the University of Pennsylvania underwent a major restructuring process in which staff members' roles were completely changed, shaking many people out of years of complacency while their seemingly secure future disappeared. People felt worried about losing their jobs, but equally important, they felt demoralized about losing the image they'd had of themselves as privileged to be working at Penn, an Ivy League school. Although the restructuring was important for the future of the school, the process itself made people fearful and reticent. President Judith Roden and Executive Vice President John Fry recognized that they needed to do something to mobilize people's energy around keeping Penn on track with its change agenda. So they looked to a broader agenda, to the community outside the university, for the inspiration that would engage staff members' hearts and minds and attune them to a common vision. Their first move was to announce that it was the university's responsibility to contribute to its outside community rather than simply taking from it. It was a position that Penn and the West Philadelphia community that surrounded it hadn't heard for many years. In fact, the university and the town had long experienced a strained relationship, arguing about when and where development and construction should take place, whose job it was to maintain a clean and safe environment, and who was responsible for dealing with increased crime. Roden and Fry's vision was more than rhetoric. It led to concrete action. They worked with city officials, school teachers and principals, and police and real estate professionals to create new, brightly lit streets and parks, to enhance the quality of education in the local schools, and to make it possible for residents to access funds to restore their homes. They created a mortgage program that encouraged Penn professors and staff to move into the area surrounding the university, and they focused on developing new hotels, retail stores, and services that were attractive to residents and visitors alike. They also undertook an ambitious effort to employ local residents and to contract with minority-owned and women-owned West Philadelphia-based businesses in construction projects and other business dealings. As the benefits of getting on board with this new strategy became obvious to people inside Penn, staff came together with energy and passion around the change process. Who could argue with building friendly relationships with the neighborhood? Who could argue with the new parks and lights, the dramatic decrease in crime, the attractive renovation of homes, and the chance to move to a vibrant, exciting urban area with the help of creative financing? The values driving the strategy, urban renewal and a commitment to a vibrant, diverse community, were intrinsically appealing and rewarding to people, making them feel good again about being part of Penn. What that broad-based move did for West Philadelphia is obvious today in the way the city looks and functions, but what it did inside the university was equally impressive. By engaging people at the university in the West Philadelphia initiative, Roden and Fry were able to also engage them in other, more difficult issues. Staff came to understand that their leaders really did believe in the values at the heart of the change process, and people began to trust them to carry through the more difficult internal change agenda with integrity. In the end, Roden and Fry helped to create an organizational resonance in which people felt invested in the strategy because it was attuned to their personal values. That made the vision for change not only meaningful, but sustainable as well. Lessons: building an emotionally intelligent organization. The notion that emotional intelligence is important at work is not new, though it's only been recently that studies have begun to show how key it is to the success of any organization. Indeed, emotional intelligence and resonance in a workplace may draw on the ancient human organizing principle of the primal band, those groups of 50 to 100 people who roamed the land with a common bond and whose survival depended on close understanding and cooperation. In some ways, a band of hunter-gatherers on the ancient plains is not so different from the teams at Hindustan Lever, UNICEF, or Penn. In any resonant human group, people find meaning in their connection and in their attunement with one another. In the best organizations, people share a vision of who they are collectively, and they share a special chemistry. They have the feeling of a good fit, of understanding and being understood, and a sense of well-being in the presence of the others. It is the responsibility of emotionally intelligent leaders to create such resonant organizations. These leaders involve people in discovering the truth about themselves and the organization. They recognize the truth about what is really going on, and they help people to name what is harmful and to build on the organization's strengths. At the same time, they bring people together around a dream of what could be, and in the process, create and demonstrate new ways for people to work together. They build resonance, and then they ensure that resonance can be sustained through the systems that regulate the ebb and flow of relations and work in the organization. There are a number of rules of engagement that our research and our work with organizations suggest will help to create a resonant, emotionally intelligent, and effective culture. The research produced three key findings: discovering the emotional reality, visualizing the ideal, and sustaining emotional intelligence. Each is explored in some detail in the following sections. The first finding: discovering the emotional reality. First, respect the group's values and the organization's integrity. Visions change, but as the vision evolves, the leader needs to be sure that the sacred center, what everyone holds as paramount, remains intact. That's the first challenge, knowing what the sacred center actually is from the perspective of others, not just oneself. The second challenge is seeing clearly what must change, even when it is held dear, and getting other people to see it too. If core beliefs, mindsets, or culture really need to change, people need to drive that change themselves. It cannot be forced, so when people enter into such a change process, they need to be personally and powerfully motivated, preferably by hope and a dream, not fear. A visionary leader can impact this process positively by honoring the feelings and beliefs of the people around him while steadfastly demonstrating the benefit of moving toward the dream. Next, slow down in order to speed up. A target shooting coach we know tells his students, "If you're in a combat situation, you can't miss fast enough to save your life." So too with building resonance and an emotionally intelligent organization. The shotgun approach to change doesn't work. The process of slowing down and bringing people into the conversation about their systems and their culture is one we don't see enough in organizations, but that nevertheless is critical. Processes such as dynamic inquiry require a supportive coaching approach and democratic style. The leader must really listen to what people have to say about the culture and the emotional reality of the organization. Both the coaching style, where a leader deeply listens to individuals, and the democratic style, where a group in dialogue builds consensus, can ensure that people are brought into the change process in a way that builds their commitment. Emotionally intelligent leaders rely on these styles as a way to slow things down enough to get a strong sense of exactly what's needed to give people the support they need to flourish. Then, start at the top with a bottom-up strategy. Top leadership must be committed to facing the truth about the emotional reality of the organization, and they must be committed to creating resonance around a vision of the ideal. But that's not enough. A bottom-up strategy is needed as well, because resonance only develops when everyone is attuned to the change. This means engaging formal and informal leaders from all over the organization in conversations about what is working, what is not, and how exciting it would be if the organization could move more in the direction of what is working. Taking time out to discuss these kinds of issues is a powerful intervention. It gets people thinking and talking and shows them the way. Once the excitement and buy-in builds, it's more possible to move from talk to action. The enthusiasm provides momentum, but the movement needs to be directed toward the dream, toward collective values, and toward new ways of working together. transparent goals, an open change process, involvement of as many people as possible, and modeling new behaviors provide a top-down, bottom-up jumpstart for resonance. The second finding, visualizing the ideal. First, look inside. To formulate a vision that will resonate with others, leaders need to pay attention, starting by tuning into their own feelings and the feelings of others. The facts alone, for instance, what is happening in the marketplace, do not provide enough information to create a meaningful vision that will touch people's hearts. To do that, a leader needs to see at the level of emotion, then craft a meaningful vision with which people can identify on a deep and personal level. Next, don't align, attune. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.